Hi, I'm Marco Werman at The World. We've been asking listeners and readers for support as we cover one of the biggest stories of our time. Thank you for the many messages of gratitude and encouragement, and yes, financial support as well. There are many worthy places seeking your help during this pandemic. If you think independent and accurate journalism is part of the solution, now is a good time to show your support for The World. Right now, all contributions will be matched by an anonymous donor who believes in fair, free global reporting. That means your gift of $50 will provide $100 of support for The World's coverage. Our journalism has never been behind a paywall, but it does cost money to bring you these important stories, reported with nuance, context, and voices from the front lines of our interconnected world. We are asking for your support to make sure this essential reporting remains freely available, always, for everyone. We're grateful when you listen to public radio, and especially grateful for your support of The World's nonprofit journalism. And you have a unique opportunity right now to double the impact of your financial support. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute today, while your gift will have twice the impact. Or follow the link right here in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. President Trump says he's stopping all immigration, but can he? We'll answer that. Trump's tweet might appeal to his base. For many Latinos, though, in conservative Texas, the president's rhetoric is insulting.
To see immigrants being portrayed in such a negative way is just really, I think it's un-American, first of all, but it's also very hurtful.
Also, a secret autonomous region on the Chinese border, the Hua State, it's run by armed groups and they're clamping down hard.
The whole area is shut down and the army is patrolling the border.
Plus, paying to get rid of oil and remembering a Caribbean presence in the New York area who has died of COVID-19.
It's Saturday morning on the Gil Bailey Show. We are getting down, people.
Those stories and more today here on The World. Late last night, President Trump took to Twitter. He sent out a note saying he would sign an executive order to temporarily suspend immigration into the United States, with an explanation point at the end of that tweet. But can he do this? The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joins me. What is in the executive order, Monica?
Well, we don't know yet. It appears that the administration is working out the logistics and a draft of this order. All we know so far is that the president tweeted that immigration would be largely stopped into the United States.
And so much immigration has already been stalled or halted by the Trump White House. Practically speaking, what more can Trump do to limit immigration? How close to zero is the U.S. already?
We're pretty close to zero. Immigration has largely shut down, especially in the last couple of months because of the coronavirus crisis. We've seen international air travel largely suspended. The refugee program has pretty much been frozen. So has visa processing, both for people wanting to enter the United States and for people in the U.S. hoping to change their status here. Offices aren't processing the paperwork. I've also seen tight restrictions at U.S. borders, including at the U.S.-Mexican border, where all migrants and asylum seekers are being turned away. A lot is being done already to restrict immigration. What we expect this order to fulfill in some ways is to broadcast that out. Broadcast out that the U.S. is walling off people who may potentially be bringing the virus, that is, you know, obviously it's steeped in xenophobic and racist language. That as the more of the spotlight moves to the economy and how the economy is doing, we can expect that spotlight will shift to blaming immigrants as people who may be threatening U.S. jobs. So this is an order that will double down on what the U.S. is already doing, and then we'll see what more might be expanded in terms of more restrictions on immigration.
For immigration and customs enforcement, detention and deportation continue, though, and we see the reports of some deportees testing positive for COVID-19. So isn't there an inherent contradiction in what Trump is doing? He doesn't want foreigners bringing disease here, but the U.S. will deport people to their countries who have the illness.
Absolutely. What we're seeing is that in the immigration detention centers, that COVID-19, that positive cases of the virus are spreading. many detention centers are reporting positive cases.
Monica, are you able to assess the human impact of what a full stop on immigration could mean?
Absolutely. For immigrants in the United States, there's a lot of worry when it comes to the administration doubling down on immigration. And we've seen the Trump administration getting hit in terms of how it's been handling this healthcare crisis, and the economic crisis is becoming more front and center. There's the clear tendency with this administration that when the Trump administration is having a bad week or a bad month, it turns to immigration. It doubles down on immigrants and anti-immigrant sentiment. So a bad week or a bad month for Trump often means a bad or possibly dangerous and life-threatening time for immigrants in this country. The human face of this abroad, I've been in touch with a family from China. The parents have work visas here in the United States. They have two U.S. citizen children. They went to China to adjust their work visas and visit family. Now they're stuck in China because they can't fly into the United States. The parents are immigrants, even though the kids are U.S. citizens. So they've been stuck in China. I talked to the mom this morning, Elizabeth's son. She was literally just pulling up Trump's tweet, and this was her reaction when she read it.
Oh, my goodness. That's really hard. I knew he would make it harder. I really don't know what's going to happen.
And when she says she doesn't know what's going to happen, it's because there's no processing of their work visas. They're stuck in China. They thought it was going to be a fairly routine adjustment to their work visa status and that they'd be back in the United States and that their kids would be back in school here in California. And now their kids are not able to go to school in China, and they're doing crazy homeschooling from China in California. And this is what the mom said.
It's just very hard for them staying in China because, you know, they cannot go to the public school. They don't have a Chinese passport.
You know, these kids are in limbo. The whole family's in limbo. Normally, these kids should be in school in California, but who knows when they'll be able to come back to the United States.
That's the world's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. President Trump said his reasons for a temporary halt on immigration are to fight the coronavirus and protect American jobs. On the surface, it sounds reasonable, but we scratch deeper with Alex Narasta. He's the director of immigration studies at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank. There is a long history in this country, as you know, Alex, and other countries, of blaming immigrants for spreading disease. In the case of coronavirus, you've looked carefully at the data. What does it show us?
It shows no relationship between immigrant populations on the county level in the United States and either COVID-19 cases or deaths once we control for population density. So there's really no evidence that immigrants are the source of the growing infections in the United States.
And to the question of jobs, 22 million Americans were laid off in the last month. Any one of them could be forgiven, perhaps, for thinking, yes, please reduce competition for jobs. Explain why it's not that simple, though.
What we're taking a look at now is the only people who are really allowed in are low-skilled, temporary agricultural guest workers and a handful of others. Low-skilled Americans or Americans who are just unemployed due to this virus are not going to be working in a lot of these industries, partly because they already have generous unemployment benefits that would go away once they start working. So essentially, the government is paying a lot of Americans who have lost their jobs not to work. So to supply these essential services, these essential activities that we need, low-skilled or other migrant workers are going to be essential to fill those niches.
Is it useful to look at the 1918 flu, which happened in the midst of a large spike of immigration from southern Italy and eastern Europe to the U.S.? Like, what can we learn from 1918 that you think is instructive today?
Well, in 1918, the government did not respond to the pandemic by closing immigration. In that year, we had over 100,000 legal immigrants come to the United States. Furthermore, a lot of the evidence suggests that that flu in 1918 started in Kansas. It didn't come from abroad. There are different theories about this, but there's really not much we can take from that directly because it was sort of a homegrown virus. So halting immigration wouldn't have done anything back then. But even so, at that time, there is no push in policy to halt immigration for the purposes of preventing the spread of the virus.
When you saw Trump's tweet last night, did you take its message at face value?
I have no choice but to take all of his messages at face value. I think that's the conundrum that a lot of us are in. I do think that since the beginning of his administration, since he started even running for president, he wanted to severely restrict legal immigration to the United States. He's done so multiple times through executive orders and executive actions since his first week in office. This is just a continuation of this. Now, to be clear, trying to limit the spread of a disease across borders is absolutely a legitimate function of immigration authorities in the United States. If this executive order were to do that, then that would be fine. But the problem is the virus is already here. It's already spread around the world. It's in most communities in the United States. So trying to halt immigration at this point just won't have an effect.
Alex Narasta, the Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute, thanks for your thoughts. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
If you've lived in the tri-state area around New York City and you heard reggae or rocksteady on the radio any time over the past few decades, there's a pretty good chance you were hearing a set DJed by Gil Bailey. Today, Caribbean Americans are mourning the broadcast legend. Gil Bailey died of COVID-19 last week. Originally from Jamaica, Bailey was known as the godfather of reggae radio. WNYC's Beth Fertig has this remembrance.
It's Saturday morning on the Gil Bailey Show. We are getting down, people.
For almost 50 years, Gil Bailey broadcast the sounds of the Caribbean to listeners throughout the New York City metro region and beyond.
When I started radio in 1969, there wasn't no one on Caribbean radio but Gil Bailey.
That's Bailey in a 2013 interview on YouTube. He got his start when a friend at a Mount Kisco radio station invited him to stop by. Reggae hadn't hit the mainstream yet. Bailey brought it to white audiences and also tapped into the Caribbean diaspora, which could only hear the music at house parties and bars.
We all grew up listening to Gil Bailey at nights.
Sharon Gordon is a journalist and broadcaster.
We put the hanger, the wire hanger, we would put it on a little transistor radio. Millennials will love this. And we would catch the radio just so the hanger could get the signal coming through the window so we could hear Gil through all the static.
She says Bailey was the first to play new songs by Michael Rose, Barris Hammond, Maxi Priest, Dennis Brown, and more.
Bob Marley did a song called Smile, You're in Jamaica Now. Get it to... I can't sing.
Jamaica, want you to smile.
And Gil played it. And I remember going up to Utica Avenue to Joe Gibbs Records looking for that song. And nobody knew the song I was talking about.
Gordon says Bailey and his wife Pat, who produced his shows, promoted more than musicians. Local Caribbean businesses got valuable exposure. Gordon worked for the Baileys in the early 90s. She says other DJs imitated his style, but some didn't care for it.
There were those who they cringed to hear the patois, the raw Jamaican patois. Greetings, you know. Hey, brethren.
But Bailey often said he was proud of his Jamaican roots and how his shows had an international reach. Here he is in a 2010 TV interview.
I'm entertaining people all over the world. People listen to us in the Caribbean, Canada, England, Germany. We get emails from all over the world.
After his wife died in 2016, Bailey took a break from broadcasting. He returned with a weekly gospel show on an AM station. His last show was in March. He was 84 years old when he died and is being mourned at home and abroad. For the world, Beth Fertig, New York City.
The coronavirus pandemic is reshaping our lives in extraordinary ways and making us fluent in topics we didn't even know about a few weeks ago, from antibody testing to the politics of public health to the pain of loneliness. We at The World are committed to bringing you essential reporting on a story that is truly touching every corner of the globe. Stay with us here on the radio and in your podcast feed and find more of our in-depth reporting on COVID-19 at theworld.org/coronavirus. That's theworld.org/coronavirus. Just ahead, we dip into the oil market in Canada. You're listening to The World. We know you value what we do here at The World. Right now, during the outbreak of COVID-19, our global coverage is a critical source of information for listeners and readers. Today, we are asking you to support our freely available fact-based reporting. When you support The World, your donation will be doubled by an anonymous donor who, like you, values the important stories, global context, and critical voices we bring you every weekday from the front lines of our interconnected world. These days, more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking you to help support it and have your donation matched. Go to theworld.org/give. And don't forget, your donation will be doubled by an anonymous supporter. If you have never contributed to The World before, now is the time to give. That's theworld.org/give. And thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. You've all heard the strange economic news about oil and how cheap it is right now. If you're in the market for a barrel of crude, a producer will actually pay you to take it off their hands. This is just a temporary blip in the futures market. In time, things are expected to get back to normal. In the short term, though, negative prices are stressing out a lot of oil producers who've got high production costs. Alberta is the heart of Canada's oil industry. Kevin Byrne with IHS Market is based in Calgary. What is the mood up there right now, Kevin?
Well, I think there's a lot of pressure and a lot of nervousness, not necessarily about the trades that occurred yesterday, but more, most of the production here is a long-term game, which is really the backbone of this industry is the oil sands. And those producers do tend to see the longer game here. But the reality is when they look at prices, it is a game of how long will these low prices last rather than what's the drop from a day-to-day basis.
So what are the kinds of producers who are in trouble in Canada? I mean, like oil, shale, or tar sands or whatever, and what difference do extraction processes make in the kind of impact Western Canada is facing?
Yeah, so Western Canada is very diverse in terms of the types of extractive technologies. The majority of the production here is from the Canadian oil sands, and the majority of the output is a heavy sour crude oil. Each type of extractive technology has its own challenges in low price environments and the ability to throttle back. In the large oil sands, there's mining operations that have large work crews. You're going to reduce those work crews due to health and safety concerns with the coronavirus itself. In the thermal operations, you can have challenges reducing output. You need to keep the reservoirs warm. If you allow them to fully cool, you can damage them. And depending how the facility is actually configured, they can get some pretty dramatic reductions in production for a temporal period of time. This is something they can't do indefinitely, but they can definitely do it for a period of several months to pull back and see some pretty dramatic reductions in output. And that's what we're hearing is happening, and that's what we expect to happen.
Yeah, people who depend on these companies for their livelihoods, for their jobs, what kind of pressure are you hearing?
We're hearing... It's a lot of pressure. I think the realization of how deep this is and how bad this is may not be fully appreciated yet, simply because you're kind of getting a multiple story hit. You know, you've got the novel coronavirus and everybody's told to hunker at home and you're not going to work anyways, but the work isn't necessarily there. And when we come out the other side, you know, the industry will not look like it was before. They'll not be able to employ the same amount of people. And so there may not be the same pull out the other sides. There are steps the federal government is taking and the provincial government is taking, trying to shore up the industry, as particularly the service sector, providing them cleanup of orphan wells or wells that are no longer in use and keep the service sector busy to maintain the capacity. So on the other side, the industry can come out this quicker, but certainly the industry is going to look a lot different. And there's a lot of people that are going to be affected. And the reality is we're going to see insolvencies and consolidations through this.
So oil extraction in Western Canada is expensive and not economically viable unless oil is selling a certain level. I mean, could the new normal essentially be the end of the industry?
I don't think so. Prices are going to have to come up at some point. This is just not a situation that's normal. That's just not the way the world is. Once we see reductions in the stay at home and the coronavirus passes, we expect a lot of the activity to return. And certainly it may not look like it was in 2019, but it's certainly not going to be where we are today.
Kevin Byrne, analyst with IHS Market in Calgary. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to our series, Every 30 Seconds. That's how frequently a young Latino in the U.S. turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote. Today we head to Texas. Reporter Stella Chavez from KERA in Dallas introduces us to a Mexican-American teen ready to graduate high school.
Iscan Ordaz voted for the first time on Super Tuesday in March. He's 18 and a high school senior. Iscan says he was excited about this key moment in his young life.
I had an old teacher tell me that the first time his children voted, they were in line and people were like, hey, we got some first-time voters, woo, and everybody was like cheering and applauding.
Iscan says voters walked into the polling location, picked their candidates, and walked out.
But when I got there, it was like not at all what I was expecting.
Still, he got to vote. As for those other milestones, like prom, graduation, they haven't been canceled, but they aren't happening in May. The COVID-19 pandemic has upended daily life for everyone around the world. And for high school seniors like Iscan, it's denied them of these traditional rites of passage. Break it down all on the floor because I'm bleeding red and gold. Under pressure, we don't fold. Including performing this song at his prom. It's called Friday Night Lights, an ode to his high school. Iscan and his friend co-wrote it during football season last fall.
That would be really unfortunate, you know, if I wasn't able to do that, because that was kind of like a dream that we had, and we've been working at it to make sure, you know, it can play out.
Like most students, Iscan is trying to adjust doing schoolwork from home. He connects with teachers via the online app Zoom, and he's turned his bedroom into his classroom. Iscan says it's not as easy as he thought it would be.
Overall, I think it's been pretty hard to study and to try to learn something. It might just be mixed with like a little bit of the senioritis that I'm already feeling. But I think the loss of schedule and the loss of routine has really made it hard for a lot of students to stay on top of their work.
Before the pandemic, Iscan talked about the issues he was most concerned about, the cost of college and student loans, and who he would vote for. He liked Democratic candidate Mike Bloomberg, but ended up voting for former Vice President Joe Biden in the primary. Iscan says he thought Bloomberg didn't have the support he needed to win the Democratic nomination. And unlike many other young Latinos, he wasn't sold on Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Ideologically, some of the socialism things that he embraces, I just understand that America is just still more individualistic.
Iscan lives in Keller, a suburb of Fort Worth, known for good schools and good neighborhoods, and where the average household income is more than $145,000. He says Texas conservatism has influenced him and points out his parents are actually more liberal than he is. They were Bernie Sanders supporters. When it comes to President Donald Trump, though, Iscan and his parents agree. They don't want to see him reelected.
It's been very difficult, and definitely politics and race is a main topic. You know, obviously I'm a citizen of the U.S., but I'm also an immigrant, you know, from Mexico, and very proud of that culture.
That's Simon Ordaz, Iscan's dad. He and wife Xochitl Ortiz sit across from Iscan in their dining room one afternoon in late February. This was during my first visit with the family.
That's what I bring to the table here in the U.S. So I have been definitely very hurt.
Simon Ordaz tears up. Iscan stretches his arm toward his dad and gives him a fist bump. Xochitl, his mother, who was born in Chicago, jumps in. She says most immigrants who come to the U.S. are seeking a better life for themselves and their families.
To see immigrants being portrayed in such a negative way is just really, I think it's un-American, first of all, but it's also very hurtful.
Iscan says even though immigration is an important issue, he's now much more worried about the economy. So he's paying attention to what the candidates do and say.
I know that if layoffs continue to escalate, if unemployment applicants continue to rise, then it could really start to reflect what is being done.
But while he waits for November and for stay-at-home orders to end, Iscan says he still holds on to hope of having a graduation and prom later this year. Friday night lights and I feel gonna rock. Let them all know. For The World, I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
News headlines are next. You're listening to The World. Adventurous cooking at home during lockdown. Get ready to up your game. You can now learn from a 3-star Michelin chef.
Not waste anything and give the right idea of what you can do with leftover food.
Going online to turn leftovers into gold with Chef Massimo Bottura That's coming up here on The World. After a year and a half of political paralysis, at last Israel has a government. Turns out a pandemic accomplished what three elections could not. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his political rival, Benny Gantz, are forming an emergency unity government for 3 years. The two men will rotate as prime minister. Netanyahu's explanation by way of Twitter: I promise the state of Israel a national emergency government that will act to save the lives and livelihoods of Israeli citizens. Israel has nearly 14,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Nearly 200 people there have died from it. Some on Israel's left are denouncing the agreement because it allows Netanyahu to delay a trial. He's charged with bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Today is also Holocaust Remembrance Day. At the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Israel, singers and speakers addressed an empty room. Nearly 400,000 Holocaust survivors are believed to be alive worldwide. Among them is Gisele Sikowitz. In 1944, on a train to the Auschwitz death camp, Sikowitz's father told her, "To make yourself useful, that's how you survive." She never saw her father again. After the war, Sikowitz moved to the U.S., became a psychologist, married, and had three children. Today she's 93 and living in Jerusalem, and like many of us, is in forced isolation. I asked Sikowitz how this day of remembrance compares.
Normally, I would be, this time of the year, I would be in Poland, because I also go to Poland to accompany high school kids. And we go through all the sites, of the many sites of the Shoah. And I talk about the Shoah. I am the, what they call, witness.
Right. This year, for Holocaust Remembrance Day, who are you thinking about specifically? Who's on your mind?
Always on my mind is my parents. My father worked for 5 months in coal mines on 200 grams of bread a day. That was the entire food, other than a soup, which was water in which some weeds. And when they were brought back to Auschwitz, to Birkenau, his face was all black from the coals that they didn't have a chance to wash. And he was a skeleton without any flesh on his bones. And he met somebody from my town, Hust, and he said, "Today 200 Jewish men were brought back to Auschwitz from the coal mines where they worked." And he said, "Tomorrow we won't be here anymore." He was 49 years old.
49. Okay?
Yes. And he knew all along, this is my biggest pain, that they knew that they are going to be killed by gas. Can you imagine this? We knew that something like this exists and that it may happen any moment in Auschwitz, that they should take us and put us into the gas chamber. But it wasn't imminent. We didn't know for sure. But they knew we are now going to go into the gas chambers and be killed there.
Hmm. Gisele, as you said, you'd normally be in Poland doing the tours of these sites with young people this time of year. Is it harder to have these memories this year with no one around you to share them with?
No, I live alone the whole year. Years, many years. I've been living in Israel. I came from America 28 years ago, 1992. And I've been living alone, and it's fine for me. I am very active. I've been working. I'm still on a payroll. I still have patients. And I have now, in this week, from the beginning of the holidays, I've had maybe 200 telephone calls. Every minute of the day, somebody calls to say, to wish a good holiday and to remember the Shoah, and to wish me good health. And so I'm not alone. and I talk to the children a few times a day. And I have, thank God, 21 grandchildren and a large number of great-grandchildren. So I don't feel alone. And I have a Filipino lady who is with me 24 hours a day, and she's wonderful.
Holocaust survivor Gisele Sikowitz in Jerusalem, thank you very much for sharing your memories and thoughts with us on this Holocaust Remembrance Day. Stay healthy.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Since the Arab Spring in 2011, Libya never settled down. To this day, fighting continues there. This week, the UN warned of a humanitarian crisis in Libya. On top of that, there's the coronavirus. The world's Halima Gikandi has our story.
The latest round of fighting in the capital, Tripoli, began about a year ago. On one side is General Khalifa Haftar and his Libyan National Army. On the other is the United Nations-backed Government of National Accord. After years of civil war, the violence is now on people's doorsteps. Kasper Ingborg is a top UN official for Libya.
Continuing to see attacks on medical facilities, And we still experience civilian casualties as a result.
Numerous ceasefires have failed to take hold. The UN hoped that the coronavirus would change that. Last month, the UN Secretary General called for a global ceasefire.
That unfortunately has not happened. The fighting has continued. It has even escalated in some areas.
I spoke with Maysam Mabrouk. She's the co-founder of a charity organization called Tripoli Good. She's currently studying in England, but has been getting calls every day from her family and friends in her hometown of Tripoli.
I remember my mom telling me about a relative of ours who was hit while they were doing barbecue at night. A rocket came close to them and two of them died, and the other three are currently in the hospital.
Maysam left Tripoli back in September. Then the fighting was bad. Now, her family says it's the worst it's ever been.
They have these bombing going every day, and they don't feel safe at home, but they don't have the option to leave because there's nowhere else to go.
The coronavirus has made things worse. In March, Libya recorded its first case. Authorities announced a nationwide lockdown and closed the borders. Mohamed Abrawi is a Libyan doctor on a fellowship at Harvard. He says the country's healthcare system was already struggling before the civil war and before coronavirus.
Now in Libya, when you go to many of the public facilities, you actually have to bring the gloves, the antiseptics. Like, you have to bring everything because the hospitals don't have anything.
Abrawi says those who can afford to typically go abroad for medical treatment. That's one of the reasons he founded a telemedicine company that connects Libyans with doctors at home and abroad. It's called Spital, which translates into place of care. Now Abrawi is working with the Libyan government on a mobile app for coronavirus.
There's no much transparency. So what we're doing here, we're giving this kind of trusted tool for the government to communicate the resources that they have available to the public.
Here's how it works. Libyans download the app and fill out a questionnaire about their symptoms and health history. Then users are divided into those who are unlikely or likely to be infected. High-risk candidates are then sent for testing.
And then these patients will be directed to the testing centers which are closest to them. And we also inform testing center there is a patient that's coming. This is the file number. Make sure that you're ready for them.
Abrawi says a trial version of the app went live in Tripoli last week. He hopes it will eventually connect the whole country. Still, that's a big task for a country divided and at war. Besides the UN-backed government and the forces of General Haftar, there are rebel factions and foreign mercenaries fighting too. Dr. Inas Alangab works for the National Center for Disease Control in Tripoli. She says health officials are focused on one thing.
Keep the number as low as possible to flatten the curve so we don't get a high number of patients suddenly, because we don't have the facilities to cover all these patients.
Angab is helping to put the new mobile phone app into the hands of local health workers. She says it could be a lifesaver for Libyans living under quarantine.
Sometimes when there's a conflict or something, the streets get blocked. and you might need to go to that hospital or go to meet that doctor. But because the streets are blocked, you can't leave your house.
She hopes the new coronavirus app will help keep people at home and limit the number of people going to hospitals because they could be a source of infection. But the continued fighting in Tripoli means that for many, home is not a safe place to stay. And there's no mobile app to fix that. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Governments everywhere are struggling to fight the coronavirus, but what about places without a government? That's the situation along the border of China and Myanmar. In the mountains there, the United Wa State Army is the government for 500,000 people. They control an area larger than Massachusetts. The World's Patrick Nguyen tried to find out how the armed group is facing the pandemic.
It takes a lot to scare these guys. They're soldiers from an ethnic group called the Wa. And the Wa have a reputation for being excellent fighters that goes way back. Even the British Empire couldn't conquer them in the late 1800s, when most Wa were only armed with swords. Now they have 30,000 troops, men and women, with modern-day weapons. That's from a video of a training exercise. The United Wa State Army, they aren't really rebels. They're not trying to start their own country, but their territory is technically inside Myanmar. And Myanmar lets them run things up there because, well, no one wants a problem with Wa soldiers. Everyone knows they're good at fending off invaders. But what if that invader is invisible and isn't scared of anyone? I reached out to a top officer from this armed group to ask, how are you fighting the coronavirus?
So basically, their message is that they're taking it seriously. The whole area is shut down and the army is patrolling the border.
That's actually the voice of an interpreter, Xi Shigeng. The officer we reached did not want his name or his voice on the radio, but he told us, look, we are on total lockdown. Here's an official order in their native Wa language to stop all public gatherings. It's now almost impossible to get to Wa State unless you're a native, and even they might have to spend 14 days of quarantine in a little bamboo shelter. The good news is, so far, there are no confirmed COVID-19 cases in Wa State. Have there been tests? Unclear, but the official did explain, through our interpreter, what happens if someone has symptoms.
If they think or they find someone that might have the virus, they will send them to a Chinese medical team to get treatment.
That makes sense. Most Wa people speak Chinese. They use Chinese currency. They use Chinese mobile phone networks. Another source in Wa State tells us the armed group has checkpoints everywhere now, with soldiers in biohazard suits checking people's temperatures. And the Wa official, he says,
they were handing out face masks and sanitizing products like alcohol gel to their people.
Yep, I've seen photos of whole battalions with rifles, all wearing masks. It's hard to look tough in a surgical mask, but they pull it off. All their medical equipment, it mostly comes from China. Could the Wa people use more outside help? Probably, but when it comes to international aid from, say, Western countries, there's an obstacle. In the past, DEA officials in the U.S. have accused some Wa leaders of pretty serious crimes.
The defendants in this case are alleged to have imported more than 1 metric ton of heroin into the United States.
That's a DEA official speaking in 2005. Wa State used to have poppy fields, but destroyed them around 15 years ago. They're still gone. You can even see this in satellite images from the UN. But the reputation has stuck, and Western countries steer clear of helping the Wa. So during this pandemic, China is an important lifeline. In fact, back in January, just a few days before Wuhan went into lockdown, a Wa village on the Chinese border got an unexpected visitor. That's Chinese leader Xi Jinping saying Happy New Year. He clapped along with Wa kids as they praised him at a big gathering. It was probably one of the last big gatherings that Xi Jinping was able to attend. The Wa also have become more self-reliant. They've built their own medical clinics and good roads to get people the help they need. Their commanders are also promoting social distancing, which is hard because despite their reputation as fierce fighters, the Wa have a culture that is really social. Lots of parties, singing, dancing. Picture thousands of Wa troops in uniform, some with rifles slung over their backs, all swaying to this music, having a blast. This is from a video posted online at a recent concert for the troops, but now the fun is over. The armed group is hunkering down for the long haul, canceling parties, rationing supplies. That Wa official, he did mention that they have one thing that even the United States might envy, a healthy stockpile of surgical masks. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
For 15 years, the U.S. Air Force has kept bombers on the Pacific island of Guam, B-2s and B-52s. They're there to deter China and North Korea. Those bombers are now being pulled back to the U.S. John Wolfstall works in nuclear nonproliferation with the Global Zero Movement and previously with the Obama administration. John, thanks for being with us. What kind of planes are we talking about?
So these are America's strategic bomber force. They're the backbone of the Air Force's strategic capabilities, and they are capable of both delivering conventional bombs and also nuclear weapons.
It guaranteed rapid response, this hardware, to pretty much any conflict in the world in a matter of hours. So why is this happening?
According to the Air Force, it appears to be a shift in strategy. For the last 15, 16 years, it was determined that the United States needed to show its capability, particularly towards North Korea and China, by permanently stationing these bombers in Guam. The assumption now is that these planes are going to be returned to the United States. They can be redeployed quickly in a crisis. They could be redeployed for overflights as a signaling capability. But because these planes are getting older and because Guam is a fixed target within range of both North Korean and Chinese missiles, it really doesn't make much sense to leave them out there as sitting ducks anymore.
Yeah, so that last point you made, that perhaps Guam is too vulnerable to Chinese and North Korean missiles, is that an overriding consideration here?
So I think it's one of the factors, but I think the sense is that because the United States has not been able to achieve its goal of forcing North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons or to force China to back down from its provocative behavior in the South China Sea, I think it's basically a regrouping of our position and a shift of strategy where we will deploy these systems if and when we need them, but just keeping them in the region is rather expensive and doesn't make much sense in today's world.
As to the question, why now, does it suggest that the pressure that the U.S. has been applying on North Korea, that pressure has come to naught?
Well, I think that's true whether we redeploy the bombers or not. I think, quite frankly, this is probably an economic decision. It's rather expensive to keep these planes deployed overseas for long stretches of time. And given the extreme costs of nuclear modernization that's going on in the United States, the economic pressure that we're now going to face as a result of the deep recession, if not depression, caused by COVID, means that the Air Force simply does not have the money to build what it wants to build and keep these planes in Guam. And I think this is largely going to be driven by economics than by strategy.
John Wolfstall, former National Security Council Senior Director for Arms Control. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It's not every day that you can learn to make tiramisu from an Italian chef with 3 Michelin stars. Now you can. Massimo Bottura has gone virtual.
For the mascarpone, it's very important. Yolk, sugar, and you start adding mascarpone. Keep whipping.
Whipping it.
Keep whipping, keep whipping, keep whipping. And add more mascarpone till it gets extremely fluffy.
Bottura's restaurant, Osteria Francescana, in Modena, Italy, is widely regarded as one of the best in the world. The restaurant is now closed during Italy's coronavirus lockdown, so Massimo and his daughter Alexa have been running free cooking classes on Instagram. Kitchen quarantine, they're calling it. Bottura spoke with me from Modena.
Look at the past, no? In 1606, William Shakespeare, during the bubonic plague, he was like forced to be in his room, and he wrote Macbeth and King Lear. So I believe since day one that these are rare and precious days, and we have to do something to deserve them. It's time for you to get deep into your passion, into culture, into reading, into touching papers. And at the end of the day, it's a privilege just to be here, each in our own homes, together under the one roof that shelter the world.
Massimo, Italian cooking starts with fresh ingredients, really quality produce. Yeah. But now with limited trips to the grocery store, how has quarantine changed the way and what you're cooking?
It's about fighting food waste. For example, I'm going to present in Kitchen Quarantine, Strawberry Fields Forever. The Strawberry Fields Forever starts from the strawberry left over from yesterday, because we did a dessert with marinated strawberry. So they're going to become a sorbet. Then we're going to use the other strawberry left as a sauce at the bottom. And the last one, the most beautiful one that we didn't cut yesterday, they're going to be caramelized and put on top. So you have a sauce, a sorbet, a caramelized hot one, and you have Strawberry Fields Forever, full of flowers.
Wow.
It's about not waste anything and give the right idea to families from all over the world of what you can do with leftover food.
I gather that in some parts of Italy, a limited number of shops are starting to reopen. Do you have a sense of when your restaurant will reopen? What does the future look like?
For sure, it's going to be one of the last things they're going to reopen, restaurants. I think a restaurant like Francescana, we have tables that are very far one from the other. So it's going to be very easy for us to keep the new hygienic solution in position, you know. But the things that we have to learn is we have to learn to keep live in our everyday with gloves, with mask, because the virus is there. And so we cannot go back to what we had before.
So you live in Modena, as I said, in northern Italy. It was really hard hit by the coronavirus. What has it been like to see a place that you love, a place that really defines what you do, go through something like this?
It's very difficult to explain. I'm trying not to talk about this kind of stuff because I get very emotional. You just say, you know, my wife is American, so she keep reminding me what you can do for your country. Don't ask what your country can do for you. So I'm trying to do my best to help the locals. Part of the staff every Sunday is cooking for the doctors, the nurses in the two big hospitals that we have. But also we raise the money during kitchen quarantine. So, you know, I'm just always positive and I'm trying to not to look at the negative things and the things that are really shocking me. And one thing that I don't know, I like to do is like open the window and look at the traffic light that it goes red and green and red and green, and there's no one there. It's insane, but you can hear even a light wind whispering in the middle of one of the most trafficy streets in Modena.
Massimo Bottura, a world-renowned chef in Modena, Italy. He's streaming live cooking shows on his Instagram called Kitchen Quarantine. Massimo, it is so great to meet you and hear what you're up to. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The World broadcast from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.